the Total Soccer Show and our international window preview. Today, we're keen to explore the US games with Granada and El Salvador. England are heading to Naples, not Rome, in their latest attempt to bring it home. Spain and France have made changes all round, and will Roberto Martinez Portugal be completely sound? All this, plus Graham gets to speak about Scotland's latest new start, but don't worry, listener, I'll warn you when you can skip that part. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, your friend and mine, Taylor Rockwell, who has just informed us, before we started recording, he is drinking a quadruple espresso shot coffee right now. Taylor, if you could just stop bouncing off the walls for a second and say hello.
Living on the edge.
I can hear my pulse in my eyeballs. I did not know it was a quadruple. I thought it was two shots, and then I asked for an extra. Only looking at the label did I realize that it's four shots. So yeah, I'm going to try to speak slowly, but this is about as slowly as I can speak right now.
So is this why you're the way you are?
No, my toddler refusing to sleep through the night and screaming for various reasons is why I need four shots. But then, yes, I guess the four shots does make me the way I am after not getting a night of sleep.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, good luck with that, Tater. We'll check in with you. We'll do a wellness check halfway through to see if you are still...
On the plus side, she is learning how to be just an excellent scam artist, because every night there is a new problem that has to be resolved that very quickly you realize is not actually a problem. So she is learning to hustle just at my expense.
Is that because she's doing double shots now? More productivity?
That's part of the problem, yes. Okay. She gets a quintuple shot. It's a very risky parenting strategy we've gone for.
Oh, boy. Well, good luck with that. Joining us today, Tay-Tay, our North Star for all things pies and kits, a man who's going to go and watch Anna and Elsa do some ice skating very shortly after recording, Graham Ruthven. Hello to you, sir.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. Yes, I am off to Disney on Ice after we record this. It's debatable whether that will be a higher level of sporting competition than any Scotland fixture over the next 2 weeks.
Higher, possibly.
Yeah, probably higher, let's face it.
The amount of frozen pitches you've had lately, Graham, I'm assuming this is taking place at like a Stirling Albion game that's reassigned.
Yeah, it's Dumbarton that are hosting it on their unplayable pitch. Yeah, they're just hosting Disney on Ice now. They've given up on the football and they're just hosting the Mouse House.
Ryan, I want to speculate on something. I would love to know your input. Graham, you can remain silent for this. I think in the past, I would have assumed, based on like the sort of lack of enthusiasm that Graham had for discussing Anna and Elsa on Ice, I would have thought, yeah, like he's being dragged to that. He's not going to be into it. The more I have learned about Graham Ruthven and the sort of inquisitive mind he has, the appreciation for other sport, I do wonder if he's going to come away from this evening thinking, like, ah, there's a lot of talent there. That was a really good show. I can't believe they pulled that off. I think Graham is going to enjoy this. How say you, Ryan?
I agree. I think he's going to write in The Guardian about it tomorrow. I think is he going to give us the Moana frozen truth, which one is actually better?
Yeah. I'm going to get home and open Y-Scout and then open the search tab and just type in ice skating and see what Y-Scout have on that.
There we go. Excellent stuff. Well, I hope you enjoy that. I hope your whole family enjoys that, Graham. And congratulations again for Stirling Albion being top of whatever league they're in.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey. Yes, we finally went top of the league last night with a win over Forfar Athletic. The best moment of the night, though, was that the pie man, the man who owns the pie company that supplies Stirling Albion, sought me out before kickoff to shake my hand and thank me for the promotion that I gave him on Twitter, which was like the greatest moment of the season so far. So all in all, a good night.
Free pies on coming down the line for you now?
Actually, yes, I think. So I'll do a wee Patreon review of those free pies. They're very good.
I don't know, now I
have concerns, Ryan, that there's pie influence. We're not getting the full accounting, the real picture of the pie. This is why you have to have journalistic neutrality, Graham, when it comes to the pie reporting.
Yeah, I've been bought by Big Pie.
Exactly. This is my concern.
That's what's happened to you.
Will you have pie bias or pious, if you will?
Oh, very good, very good.
Hey, okay, I did a funny. That means another thing. Why don't we talk about the international window in which we find ourselves situating? We're at the precipice of it, I suppose, as we record. We should start off, Taylor Rockwell, with the USMNT's upcoming games. We've got a trip to Granada coming up next and then hosting El Salvador in Orlando. Is that next Tuesday? Next Monday, that one is, I believe, right? So, what do we make of this one? This is CONCACAF Nations League. As Joe Lowry, who's not with us on this show has reminded us in previous shows, the object here is to qualify for the Nations League finals, which are taking place this June. And it's quite an important objective, Taylor, with the US not being in top spot to qualify at the moment, in second place in their respective CONCACAF Nations League groups. So there is work to be done.
There absolutely is, though it's worth noting El Salvador and Grenada, the other two teams in the group, have both played one more game than the U.S. So if and when the U.S. goes to Grenada and gets a win, that would put them top of the group. Then they have their final game against El Salvador. El Salvador would need to win that on the road in the United States. But first, it will be the U.S. having to get past Grenada, which theoretically, they should be able to do. I'm going to assume it's going to be a very ugly game. I'm assuming the pitch will be pretty rough. Watching some of the highlights from Granada's 2-2 draw with El Salvador at home, the pitch actually looked better than El Salvador's pitch did when the U.S. played there, but still looked very wet and slow simultaneously. It was one of those where you could sort of see, similar to what Graham will experience later with the ice skating, you could see the players not really being certain of the footing, and so everything just looked slower. It's got the running track. It looks like it's in sort of an all-sports venue. So I don't think it's going to be the best atmosphere, but I think it will require the United States to handle some of the physicality and then just be ball dominant and make chances happen, so that the El Salvador game would then require El Salvador taking the game to the U.S., and I think the U.S. will be able to handle that one. But we shall see. Ryan, my question for you on this window, you mentioned we're at the precipice of it starting. Is that sort of what this window feels like for you? It's one of those rides where you go up the ramp on the roller coaster and then it stops as you're pointed straight down and it holds you there for like 5 seconds and then releases you. Is the international window just you being held in a vertical position for like 5 days and then you get to go back to things?
I'd say it's less of a roller coaster, Taylor, more that we've just joined the queue in the traffic jam.
Oh, okay.
We're going to sit through it for a few hours.
Yeah, or the roller coaster just gets stopped at the top of the lift hill, and you need to get rescued from the top of that lift hill. It never comes back down.
So you don't even get to do it. It's you hang there like facing straight down for 5 days, and then you just slowly back down the hill, very, very slowly. That's what Ryan approach or feels like with the international window. Got it. That's right.
Hashtag disappointment. So Taylor, so for this Grenada away game, we're expecting it to be CONCACAF-esque in its, at least in its aesthetics when we tune in.
That would be my guess. Yeah, I think it's going to be a slow game. I think Grenada will try to make it a slow game. I think they will go with some physicality and get into some challenges. I don't think there is going to be VAR for these for a number of different reasons. So maybe we'll get some controversial moments that won't get looked back. Watching the USA's game in El Salvador, there wasn't VAR. And there's a few moments when Pulisic gets crushed that I think maybe would have gotten a second look if VAR were there. And I think that's something that we should sort of take into our accounting, that these are going to be sort of slog games where the U.S. historically has to find a way through. It is, especially with Grenada, weaker opposition, so they should be able to do that. It's a matter of how do they do it? Do they have the chemistry and the combinations? Are they playing quickly enough? Do they have just that level of confidence you need with some of the new players, with some of the returning faces, and with some people who have a point to prove? We've seen in the past players try to do too much and try to make things happen because they want to sort of get off on a good start, and that can be problematic. If we see the U.S. playing as a unit, moving the ball quickly, probing for opportunities, and then taking chances if and when they come, I will feel much better about things. But I do think this could be a sort of slow game, and if the United States scores one early, I think it could be even slower because they will be content with a 1 or 2-0 win, and I think Grenada won't hate that either. So I could see this being a not particularly compelling game from a U.S. perspective.
Taylor, when you said that there's going to be no VAR for this, a CONCACAF match, there's what I thought of. There's a bit in the Simpsons movie where the police robot has to dismantle a bomb or something, and the pressure's too much for it, and it takes Chief Wiggum's gun, and it essentially shoots itself. That's what VAR has done here for a CONCACAF match.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's thought, I can't take that.
Nope.
I'm out. I'm out of CONCACAF. And actually, CONCACAF didn't have a choice in that matter. VAR refused to be the VAR for that match.
It gained sentience and immediately said, now we're good. We got other things we want to work on. That makes sense. That does make sense. Yeah, so I think the Grenada game will be the one where the United States has, you know, 70% possession or thereabouts, and then it's about just moving the ball quickly, or as quickly as they can, because I'm guessing the field won't allow for just that confidence you need when you're on the ball. I think we're going to see a few extra touches. I think it will be slower, and I think it will require some individual efforts to make something happen. That's my sort of pessimistic look. The more optimistic look, this is a game the U.S. won 5-0 on home soil, so we would expect them to come in with a bit of swagger, a bit of confidence, and make something happen, especially with some of those new faces, with Daryl Dike coming back in, with Ricardo Pepi coming back in. I'm hoping both of them are able to have an impact, regardless of who starts. I hope one of them or both of them get some goals, and we're all feeling better about the U.S., or as better as we can be feeling about the U.S. after this game.
Yeah, I don't really know what we will learn about the team as a whole from these games, partly because there's no head coach or no permanent head coach at the moment. There's no GM at U.S. Soccer. There's no clear direction for 2026, so there's no framework for what the US is kind of building around at the moment. We don't know the style that they're building towards. You know, it's a very different style if Berhalter comes back as head coach to if Jesse Marsh gets hired as head coach. So I don't really know what to read into, as I say, from the team performance. I think you're probably right, Taylor, that is what we should expect. But I do think there is good value in getting the core group together again, particularly after the Berhalter-Reyna scandal and moving on from that. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have seen Christian Pulisic's interview with, I think that was with Graham Hunter for ESPN, but his comments suggest that there is a desire from the players just to push this nonsense behind them and kind of move on. And so I do think from that aspect of things, getting the core group together, the fact that there are so many players coming back from that World Cup squad is going to be quite valuable, even if in terms of the performances on the pitch are maybe not that valuable. Some of the players that are in the squad as well, you know, Alan Sonora, he looked very good the last time that we saw him. I'm disappointed that he didn't come to MLS in the end. I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do. Daryl Dike, Taylor, I know you spoke about Dike yesterday with Gas and Joe, obviously. Feels like he kind of has a bit of unfinished business with the national team. Yeah. Obviously, there was a lot of hype around him when he was in the championship at first and scoring goals for fun with Barnsley. Then injuries kind of halted him. Right now, he's got 4 goals in 5 games for West Brom. So I think there's a chance he gives the US something different. Zendayas is obviously now officially the US. So I kind of want to see where he fits into the team. De La Torre, he's playing more for Celta Vigo right now. I kind of think in a sense he was missed at the World Cup, and that I know he was in the squad, but it felt like he wasn't really fit enough to feature in any meaningful way. And so having him as a rotation option might have helped the US in that game against the Netherlands, around the 16 game, just be a little bit fresher had he been involved. So I'd like to see him contribute again. So I think in terms of the camp, there's lots that is valuable there. I think in terms of individuals, there's lots that's valuable there as well. But it's kind of difficult to assess everything all at once without that framework that I talk about.
Absolutely. And I think that is the important framework to establish, that we don't have much framework when it comes to these two games. But looking back at games past, the 1-1 draw in El Salvador, that one was more or less an experimental makeshift team. You have Ethan Horvath in goal. You have Reggie Cannon and Anthony Robinson as your fullbacks. You have Aaron Long and Cameron Carter-Vickers as your two center backs. In the midfield, it was Musa, Adams, and Aronson. More of a 4-2-3-1 shape with Aronson central, then Pulisic and Tim Way on either side with Haji Wright up top. So some of the kind of proven names, the known quantities in there, then a little bit of experimentation. You get Paul Areola subbing on in the 62nd and then getting a red card 8 minutes later. So that confused things. Then you get Jordan Morris subbing on in the 80th and I think scoring in the 90th. So he got the late equalizer there. So I say that all just to say that for people who maybe forgot about that game or didn't pay as much attention to it, it's not as though that was the U.S.'s starting World Cup squad going in and failing to get a result in El Salvador. It was a sort of secondary team, or at the time a few of those names were secondary, and what could they do with other bigger games looming on the horizon? In this case, I think we will see probably something similar, where we'll see some of the established names, some more experimental call-ins. Experimentation is probably the word I should have gone for there. And the biggest one I'm excited for is who starts at number 9. I would like it to be Daryl Dike, not because I think he's better than Ricardo Pepi, but to your point, Graham, I feel like every time we've seen him for the U.S., he is either recovering from an injury or about to get injured, aka playing too many games. And I don't think we've ever seen him sort of coming into a camp in full form, in full fitness. And this time we are. So I think this could be a great opportunity to see what he can do with some of the pressure off. It's not as though if he does well, there's a World Cup spot on the line. I think this is a chance for him to kind of stake his claim that he should be much more involved in that number nine conversation than he has been previously. And a good showing over the course of these two games would definitely help with that. And the same goes for Ricardo Pepi. So I think that alone makes these games compelling, is can either one of them be a difference maker, create a goal from nothing, or just score a goal when it doesn't seem like it's going to happen, or score a goal early and kill the game off. All of those would be welcome things to see from the number nine spot.
I'm glad you mentioned excitement there, Taylor. Excitement at the number nine spot potential, because up to this point, my TLDR was we're going to get a slow game and this window doesn't mean a lot because of the current structure of the program.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is the case. I think neutrals are... I expect a lot of people who pay attention to the U.S. at the World Cup and then maybe for like big Gold Cup games are going to be texting me like, why do we look so bad? What's going on? What, like, this is bad. The U.S. should be beating this team 10-0. And maybe that's the case. I don't think that's the case for El Salvador, though playing at home is a big difference maker for the United States. I think these games are an opportunity to evaluate individuals and just see, is there progress? Are they looking better? We won't have Tyler Adams there. So who can do the Tyler Adams job? Or will we see two players asked to do that and go with more of a 4-2-3-1? I think we're going to get to see opportunities to just see those individuals, and that's what I would focus on. I wouldn't focus on the system or the tactics other than are they playing as a unit or is it much more individual? And even there, it's hard to really draw major conclusions because we don't know who the coach will be or how things will play out. So I think the best thing people can do in watching these games is root for the win and then watch the individual players, maybe more than you normally would. And instead of focusing on the system or the style or what are the patterns of play or the rotations, look at, you know, is Aronson taking people on? Is, like, do our center backs look like they are, like, having good coordination and communication? Like, how are our goalkeepers looking? Or do they look comfortable? How's the distribution? I think evaluating just individual moments and individual sequences is probably the way to go with these games.
Yeah. Is Gio Reyna given anyone side eye? Or is anyone exactly given Gio Reyna side eye? That's what I'll be looking out for.
Careful. They don't want to do that. Graham, a general point about this window. Major League Soccer is plowing on through with its fixture list this weekend. Do we still see that as a problem? Is there going to be a point in coming seasons where they're going to stop doing that?
So I've written about this for The Guardian previously. I do see it as a problem, particularly with MLS growing in terms of the number of international players in that league. And also very important standout preeminent players for their countries in terms of who's playing in MLS. So the fact that Atlanta United, I believe Atlanta United have got a game this weekend and Thiago Almada is part of the Argentina squad. So their best player, the player who's kind of knit everything together for them in their rebuild at the start of this season, is going to be missing for a standard league match this season. I find that weird for a league like MLS, which I believe for the World Cup, MLS was sixth in the list of the number of call-ups for a World Cup for leagues around the world. So we're not talking about, you know, in Scotland, for example, the Scottish Championship will plough on this weekend and there will be one or two players from the Scottish Championship missing, but you can kind of absorb that. We're talking about tens and tens of players missing from MLS this weekend, and I do personally think that is a problem, and it's something that MLS is going to address if they want to be one of the biggest leagues in the world, because there will be players out there who will not move to MLS because it will hinder their international prospects.
Yeah, it just, for me, the problem for me is it equates them with like EFL League One and League Two, which will plow on, and I think they want to set their sights a little higher than that, right, Graham? And
possibly.
Quite possibly. By the way, AFC Wimbledon's Chris Gunter is missing Wimbledon's games in this window because he's going to be a coach with Wales during this period. So Wimbledon fans are super happy that he's taking a new job while...
Wait, so do you have a game this weekend then?
Yeah.
I presume. So yeah. he is missing a game as a player...
To be a coach for Wales. He's eyeing up his next job while doing his current one, Graham. Yeah, it's not great.
I don't know if I've ever heard of that before. That's quite incredible.
Yeah, it's not the best. It's not the best. We're not super happy about that. Taylor, before we take a break, anything else to say about these US games? Any positive notes we can strike here?
This may end up being a slightly meandering rant, so go ahead and buckle up for it. But Ryan, to your point that MLS is still playing, I kind of hate it. I really do hate it. I don't know if it will change, but I don't think it's even that big of a deal in terms of like, oh, they're not calling in certain players or certain players are going to be missing the weekend. I just keep struggling with, it's a thing I've talked about before. It's a thing that's been the case for me in years past. Every year that I'm focused on getting into Major League Soccer, I want to follow it for the majority of the season, if not the whole season, stuff like this happens, and it makes it really hard for me to take the first 10 weeks of the season seriously when it's, oh yeah, they're not in form yet, they haven't really figured it out, that guy showed up overweight for preseason, but by week 10, he should be good to go. Ah, we've got the international break, we've released some players, other people aren't being released until the later international window, and it just feels like when you're playing through all of that, everything matters and nothing matters simultaneously, and I get sort of confused as to how much I'm supposed to care about this. And I wish MLS would either just say, like, yeah, the regular season doesn't matter, or really double down and change the schedule. But I think trying to have it be, we're going to be one of the best leagues in the world, every game matters, look at all the drama, look at all the intensity, oh, but also there's a FIFA window and we're going to play right through it. It just sends mixed messages in my mind, and I think makes it hard to really get into the league when you have this break but don't have a break simultaneously.
If only there was a month-long spell in the summer, say that was filled currently by a kind of superfluous, pointless competition, that they could remove that competition and then take the time off the international breaks. Wouldn't that be an idea?
Nothing like making a decision to then hamstring yourself later and then justify being hamstrung by having to make that decision that you didn't have to make. It's a very, very definitive MLS moment in my mind.
Oh boy. All right, that feels like a good break point. Let's take a quick one. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this qualifying window, including Euro 2024 qualifying, which is upon us. Back shortly.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick and mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day to day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. We are talking international window. Taylor Rockwell, wellness check. It looks about 33% of your quadruple coffee has gone down. Feeling okay?
Huh? What? Yeah, I'm feeling great. What are you talking about? Everything's good.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Excellent.
Taylor, are you normally like on the ceiling, like in a horror film, like on all fours and ceiling? Is that normal for you?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you got to like dust the fan from the ceiling down. Why not? Well, how do you do it, Graham? What do you stand on a ladder or something? Get out of here.
What a feeling. Taylor's on the ceiling. Let's talk about Euro 2024 qualifying. The tournament, by the way, in Germany next June and July. That sounds like, oh, I'm looking forward to that one. That's going to be a proper
Just a quick beat on that. We've had so many major tournaments in kind of questionable locations and earned by questionable methods, that a tournament in Germany is very appealing to me, and it feels like the first kind of appealing tournament in terms of location since maybe 2016, because we had 2018 with the Russia World Cup. Then we had 2020, which was COVID and also just spread around Europe. So I don't really think you got a sense of any sort of place. Then you have Qatar 2022. So it feels like a while since we've had what I would say, I don't want to cause any offense, but like a proper tournament in one location where fans can actually visit, unlike Qatar, where nobody could actually go to that tournament.
It feels back to basics, doesn't it? I do like that. Euro 2028, by the way, Graham, is being shared by Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, and the Arctic Circle. So make the most of this one.
Do you know what's scary about that? Is when you started saying that, I thought you were being serious, and I was about to go, I hadn't heard that, actually, but... Yeah, maybe not the Arctic Circle. Might be beyond FIFA.
But by then it will be like a balmy 75 degrees in the Arctic Circle. So we could go ahead and have a final there. Why not?
Yeah, let's put a tournament in the future. We haven't invented the technology to make the pitch the right temperature yet. I'm thinking that we've got form for that. Anyway, I'm rambling. Let's talk about the qualifiers. Why don't we start with England, who have a game against Italy in Naples coming up on Thursday as we record, and then a subsequent game against the Ukraine. So, Graham.
Excited then, Ryan.
Another one. We start another one. Now, I've made my opinions on qualifying clear previously on this podcast, and I hate to be a grouch about it, but there's little peril for an England fan generally in qualification because it's inevitable. Quite often we go through with a perfect record, or at least something approaching that. And I don't think we learn anything about this team until we get to tournaments. Is that fair to say, Graham?
Usually, yes. That is the way it has gone for England. What I would say is this particular group does carry a little bit more peril than usual for England, because, not trying to rub salt in the wounds here, Ryan, but England are a pot two team for this group. So Italy are actually, as the European defending champions, even though they didn't qualify for the last World Cup, they are still a pot one team. Ukraine are, I believe, the pot three team, and they are probably one of the stronger pot three teams, given how good they can be. What did they make, the quarterfinals of the Euros last time out? England, this seems like a lifetime ago. England beat Ukraine quite convincingly from memory. Was it like 3-0 or 4-0 or something like
4-0 that? 4-0 in Rome, I believe, Graham.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, so you would still expect England to finish above them, but usually England are the top dogs in their group. And obviously with Italy being in there, and also the fact that England have Italy and Ukraine first, they have two of their most difficult fixtures. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that, let's say, England lose in Italy and then maybe fail to beat Ukraine. I know that's a home fixture, but let's say that's a draw. And England all of a sudden are looking upwards at teams above them. So while I still expect England to get out of this group, I do think there's a little bit more peril for them than usual.
And on top of that, I would add North Macedonia would be the team that knocked Italy out of the World Cup playoffs. I think maybe because Italy was looking ahead to their more likely game against Portugal, which North Macedonia ended up losing. But even there, it's a team that can spring a surprise. I wouldn't be surprised if England dropped points away to North Macedonia. So I think it is, you've got like a wounded Italy that have a point to prove, but also could just go bust. You've got Ukraine, obviously, with a point to prove, and North Macedonia, who can be very difficult in their own right. So I think that does make it a more compelling group than we've seen in years past when England's got, you know, teams that could be run over like Scotland.
I mean, yeah, that's fair to say. There's a five team groups here, and Malta making up the rest of the pack there for Group C. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a group of death. I mean, like, Group B's got Netherlands and France and Republic of Ireland in it, for example. There's, I suppose there's strong teams across the board here, but
So I take your point. France and Netherlands, two strong teams. Maybe if you were to take the mean of those two teams, those two teams are stronger than Italy and England, because Italy don't seem to be in a very good place right now. But I think in terms of the depth of quality, I would pick out England's group. I would also, unfortunately, pick out Scotland's group. I think that's quite a high level of competition across the board. So I am interested to see whether England do steamroll the group as they tend to do for in most qualification campaigns, or whether this one is a little bit more challenging. Because as I say, the watermark does seem a little bit higher than past groups that England have had, where there's always been a San Marino. And I know, you know, Malta are maybe the minnows in there, but Malta are more competitive than, you know, a San Marino or a Luxembourg or whatever. As I say, it is a kind of higher watermark.
Sure, I think you could make the most compelling arguments you could about why Malta are good. Ryan Bailey is never going to be concerned about Malta. I'm pretty confident of that. Ryan, what are you concerned about then with England? Or is it just that it won't be that interesting? Do you feel like no matter what, they're going to qualify? So, you know, who cares?
I'm not looking forward to the game against Italy, because I know that Italy traditionally, certainly in recent fixtures, give us England a tough time. And I don't think it's easy to go to Naples for a game, which is why I'm probably not going to do it myself. I was considering making the trip, but reading the headlines, maybe somewhere to keep a distance from as we record tomorrow. But I think, Taylor, it feels like, to me, this squad is in a period of stasis to a certain extent at the moment, because I'm seeing lots of other European nations we'll talk about soon who've got new coaches, who've got new players coming, who've got quite a big revolution happening in their squads. I look at England, there's a few players out for this. Rashford, Mason Mount are out, and there's a few new names in. Ivan Toney's getting a start here. Gambling's Ivan Toney's coming back in. Fraser Forster's in for this one. Ben Chilwell back, Reece James back in. But it still feels like the same group with the same coach who are going to do the same thing, and I don't feel like I watch this game to be entertained, I suppose. And I watch the international game, particularly, it has an extra onus to entertain. And I don't feel like I'm going to get that much from these England games. And I know I sound very cynical, but that's because I've grown up watching this team, Taylor. Well,
but is that also not part of the problem of England having Southgate there for so long and having some of the same names there for so long? Like, I don't think that's complacency. I don't even think that's necessarily arrogance. I think it's what happens when you have a lot of the same faces and a lot of the same narratives. I mean, how long has it been the case that, like, Trent Alexander-Arnold not called up on form, not because of fitness? Like, we've had this be a story for so long, it remains a story. And maybe it should be, but it just feels like we kind of are rehashing the same things over and over and over again with this England team. It's where my genuine question for you is, like, would you like them to change it up? Would you like them to call in a much younger squad just to see what happens, or change it up if things aren't going well in qualifying and bring in a new manager? Like, is there a time when you do just have to shake things up, because otherwise the rust starts to develop, things start to settle too much, there's a bit too much complacency, and maybe suddenly you are
Belgium.
Struggling to qualify. Yeah, exactly.
That is a very good point. You could become Belgium in this circumstance. But I'm inclined, Taylor, to answer your question and say no. Because if I look at that lineup, say the probable lineup which we're going to see in the next game, Walker, Stones, Maguire, Shaw, Henderson, Rice, Bellingham, Kane with Sucker and Grealish in like a 4-3-3. That is a strong team. That is an exciting looking team on paper. Whether it's exciting when they start playing on grass is another question, I suppose. Because I don't know what other ingredients I would put in that team I just said, for example. I don't know who else I'd introduce. And if you did, it would be some pretty good substitutes.
Yeah, I agree with your general sentiment there, Ryan, because I completely understand where you're coming from in terms of most other countries are starting a new cycle with a new manager, and there's that natural excitement there. And England don't have that. And I, even as a non-England fan, I'm a little bit bored by England at this point, because it is going to be the same team. It's the same manager. But then what changes do you make? What players are coming into that team that are better than the current players that are there? The one argument that I would make is someone like Phil Foden. I know he was in the squad. I know he featured in the World Cup, but maybe just finding a way to harness him as a bit more of a creator, someone like James Maddison as well, bringing him, and again, I know he was in the World Cup squad, but just making him a more important part of that team. That, to me, feels like the next progression for England. And there was a progression from the Euros to the World Cup. I do think England were better at imposing their own game on opponents in Qatar. I still feel like there's another step that they can do in that respect, or they can take in that respect. Teams like France, the very top teams, you know, the teams that can win a World Cup, France, Argentina, Brazil, England have yet to show that they can truly control and dominate a match of that stature. And that has, with the talent that England have, I think there's an argument to be made that right now England have the most talented squad in international football, but it's between France and England for that right now. A squad and a team of that talent should be able to do that against the absolute best teams in the world, and that is where England have just fallen a little bit short under Southgate so far.
Yeah. I would say the, if not saving grace, a like positive approach for England in this game will just be that I think the pressure is very much on the Italian national team and Roberto Mancini. And so I think if England win, it's all good for them. You know, they're doing what's expected. They got the result. And I think it will be, if not crisis for Italy, it will be more of an issue. Whereas if Italy win, maybe it will be a crisis for England. I think it's more defensible to go on the road to Italy and not get points. But this Italian national team is looking to rebound from failing to qualify, from getting knocked out by North Macedonia. And in those games, you have Jorginho missing penalties. You have a lot of sort of veteran players not rising to the occasion. You have younger players not really being ready for prime time. And so I think for this Italy team, you don't have Federico Chiesa, he's injured, but you don't have Ciro Immobile. He's got 55 caps total. You don't have Andrea Belotti, Lorenzo Insigne, Moise Kean. Varying degrees of experience there. But Immobile on his own, as I said, has 55 caps. If you look at the seven strikers on this Italian roster, they combined for 58 appearances. 24 of those are from Domenico Berardi. So you remove him and suddenly the other like six remaining players have 34 caps total. It's a lot of younger or less experienced when it comes to the international game players. Matteo Politano is 29. I'm not saying he's a youngster necessarily, but you've got a 17-year-old, a 19-year-old, a 23-year-old. So there are players with a point to prove, and if they do, then I think it's a sign the narrative will be resurgent Italy. If they don't, I think it will be Italy still struggling. Is Mancini the right guy for this team? With England, I think it's just going to be more of the, yeah, we'll see what happens. And so I think in that way, your neutrality, your ambivalence, I think is justified.
Yeah, I think we have a much clearer idea of what to expect from England ahead of this fixture than Italy for a number of the reasons that you outline there, Taylor. There's actually loads of stuff around Italy right now that's really interesting. So James Horncastle wrote a good piece for The Athletic, which details basically how Roberto Mancini is having to kind of create his own international stars because he feels the players just aren't there. He's calling up players to the national team before that they've even broken through at club level. So Simone Pavunde, as a player that Horncastle writes about in his piece, has barely featured for Udinese this season. He's been in the national team squad. Mancini has gone to Central and South America to call up Matteo Retegui, and the reason I don't really know how to pronounce his name is because I've never heard of him before. He's on loan from Boca Juniors at Tigre, and Mancini is basically looking all over the world, which is kind of unheard of for an Italy manager. Normally an Azzurri manager just looks at Serie A, and basically everyone in Serie A traditionally is Italian. That is not the case right now. So 33.8% of the minutes played by players in Serie A this season is by Italian players, which is the lowest it has ever been. So in terms of talent, there's a massive, massive gulf between England and Italy. I don't think anyone in Italy knows what to expect from the national team against England, and that should be to England's benefit.
Yeah, it's interesting the call-outs that have been made here, Graham. The talk of the town, certainly in Rome, is Mattia Zaccagni, my good neighbour and friend, close personal friend, who scored the winner in the Rome derby last weekend, 9 goals this season, playing great soccer for one of the best teams in Italy, not called up. Whereas, as you mentioned, some lesser-known names getting the nod. So there's some curious decisions going on.
Matteo Retegui or Retegui, however we're going to pronounce that. I've texted my wife. She knows Italian pronunciation. If I didn't know better, I would have thought he was a sort of like a player that FIFA didn't get the rights to playing for a team that wouldn't give their rights up, because Matteo Retegui playing for Tigre and the Italian national team, I'm not familiar with Tigre in Argentina either. I don't think I would have even known that they were a team. I know Tigres. So that already had me sort of captivated by like, who is this guy? Who is this team? What's going on? I don't understand. So I think I'm definitely more excited to see how Italy look than I am England. Sorry, Ryan. I apologize.
Taylor, by the way, just text your wife for Italian pronunciations. Not the guy who literally lives in Italy. Don't worry about that. Yeah.
Oh, you mean the guy who every single time we mention Italy like speaks about it with disdain and dislike and goes to Starbucks and Chili's and Hard Rock Cafe instead of eating Italian food. Yeah, why would I think that he doesn't want to talk about Italian pronunciation?
The man who brings back Kraft macaroni cheese to Italy from America.
That's true pasta. That's real pasta, Graham.
That was for my American-born children.
Oh,
know
yeah,
nothing
sure,
better, Graham.
Sure. That's excuses.
Well, Ryan, what would you say then?
About what?
How do you pronounce his name?
Well, it's technically a French surname, Retegui, right? It's not Italian. It's Retegui, I would say.
Okay.
Am I wrong?
I have nothing to contribute.
Oh, this is where it gets even more confusing because he's born in Argentina. So now I really don't know what to tell you. We've talked about this before where a really sizable percentage of the population in Argentina has connections to Italy. So now I'm really thrown for a loop because I don't know if it's Spanish pronunciation or Italian pronunciation.
Yeah, and I don't think it's an Italian origin surname either. So I could be wrong. I'm wrong about many things. But we should probably, why don't we talk a little bit about Spain? Should we move on to Spain, who are facing Norway and Scotland in this window? Ooh.
Yeah, I've got tickets for that one. Nice. And there's not a Stirling Albion game that's clashing with it, so I'll actually be able to go to that game next Tuesday.
Well done. So Spain, who obviously got Luis de la Fuente as the coach now appointed after the World Cup, who's got experience with the youth setup in Spain at various levels.
Yep.
What, Graham, do we make of this new Spain era?
Interesting at the moment. So obviously we don't have any evidence. We'll have evidence after these two games of how De La Fuente will truly change things. But he is a very different coach and person to Luis Enrique. So tactically, I think it's expected that De La Fuente will shift into a 4-3-3-1. Of course, Lucho never really changed from a 4-3-3, even when fans and experts were calling for it. And De La Fuente just generally is more of a pragmatist than Luis Enrique, which I think is a good thing. In terms of international soccer, I am very much pro-pragmatism, and Lucho was very much an idealist. What we saw from him was kind of the purest form of tiki-taka that exists in the modern game. Still, we have kind of moved away from that style of play. Obviously, it's still the bedrock of what a lot of teams do, but I think there needs to be a little bit more dynamism to Spain's play. And the idea is that De La Fuente will do that. He does like to play an orthodox central striker. As you mentioned, Ryan, he has coached the youth teams. He's very much a company man for the Spanish Federation in that he's coached the U19s, the U21s, the U23s. He won the youth Euros at 19s and 21s level. He led Spain to silver medal at the Tokyo Olympics a couple years ago. So he has had success at international level. In terms of his character, he is very different to Lucho as well. So Lucho was never afraid to speak out against the Federation. I think there's a lot of people at the Spanish Federation on the edge of their seats whenever Luis Enrique held a press conference, and De La Fuente won't really do that. I don't expect we'll get many interesting quotes out of him. We certainly won't get a Twitch stream out of him during a major tournament. But one of the most interesting things about this change is that De La Fuente has kind of overhauled the squad for these games. So only 11 players survive from the World Cup squad, which is a bigger overhaul of the squad than I expected. And his hand has been forced a little bit by injuries. So Pedri is probably the biggest miss. And I think Spain are a different team when he's involved. They find it much easier to play through the lines. So I'm interested to see if anyone can kind of step in for him in these games. But there's some really surprising inclusions. So Brian Hill is maybe the most surprising one for me, given that he has not played a lot, and when he has played, not been very good for a bad Sevilla team that have just sacked their manager. So surprising to see him there. Iago Aspas is back in the squad. I personally think Lucho should have used him more. Even though he's 35 now, he's still a pretty reliable goal scorer. He has played well for Spain in the past as well. Busquets has retired since the World Cup, so that's a big question. Who's going to replace him at the base of the midfield? I would say Rodri feels like the front runner for that. But there's also Zubimendi, who's been called up for the first time. He could be a contender for that role. The one thing that De La Fuente does agree with on Lucho is David De Gea. David De Gea still not in this squad. I think Spain want to have a goalkeeper who's more comfortable playing out from the back, and so it's David Raya and Kepa and one other, I can't remember. It's another Premier League goalkeeper, I can't quite remember.
Robert Sanchez.
That's the one, Robert Sanchez, yeah. So you can kind of see that how the way that De La Fuente wants to play it from the back, from his goalkeeper selection. But yeah, there's a lot of change happening here. As I say, more change than I expected. I think Spain after the World Cup, they only needed to kind of tweak things, but it feels like De La Fuente's got different ideas and he kind of wants to very quickly put his own mark on this team.
I just like that De La Fuente, before he took over the Spain youth teams and now the Spanish senior team, he was with Bilbao, Sevilla, and Alaves. We've got a Bilbao player. We've got a Sevilla player in the squad. No Alaves. I think that's maybe Alaves' fault, less so the manager. But I agree with Graham. I think we're seeing an interesting time for Spain where they've brought in, I wouldn't say like the sexiest hire, but at the same time, they've brought in a person who's very familiar with a lot of these players and has been there for a while. And it just feels like the type of appointment that doesn't make a ton of headlines, but then does end up having an impact. So I think that alone is reason for watching Spain in this international window. Aside from all the talent we know they will have and we've come to expect from them, I think it's seeing how quickly this squad gels around a new manager. I think that is definitely going to be the thing I will be keeping an eye on.
Mm. Maybe not a sexy hire, Taylor, but a sexy name. Luis De La Fuente.
Oh, yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Big fan of that.
Ivan De La Red is still my favorite one. But yes, De La Fuente is second.
Well, that's good.
Very good indeed.
And Jan Vonnegor of Hesselink, always the greatest name in football.
Let's take a quick break. But when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about qualifying Group A, which includes Scotland. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. We are discussing Euro 2024 qualifying Group A. We've had a little chat about Spain. Who else in the group should we talk about, Graham? Georgia, Cyprus, Norway? What do you think?
Us. Talk about us.
Fine, go on then.
Yeah, so Scotland are in Group A. It's quite a difficult group. I'm still a little bit unhappy that we've landed in this one because the pot three team is Norway and Erling Haaland, who, by the way, will not be available to face Spain, but I bet that he is fit and firing for that game against Scotland.
Do you think so, Graham? Because I had a theory about this, because apparently he got injured in that Burnley game where he scored a billion goals, where no one saw him get injured. Do you remember when Ryan Giggs used to conveniently miss every international window? Just mentioning that for no reason particular, in that he might miss both these games.
I remember more than just Ryan Giggs doing that. I remember that being a thing that a lot of Manchester United players did in the international break, I presume, under instructions from Sir Alex Ferguson. So maybe Pep truly is the new Fergie and that's what's going on here. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that by the time Norway face Scotland, I believe this summer, which would be at the end of the season, Pep's probably not caring that much about keeping Haaland fit at that time. So go and score 20 goals against Scotland, sure. In terms of Scotland's chances in qualifying, I'm still in a huff that we didn't qualify for the World Cup. It was very Scottish that we didn't. We won 7 out of 12 games. 10 games, 7 out of 10. We drew 2 and lost 1 game away to Denmark. Still didn't qualify for that World Cup. So I do feel like we were good enough to be at that tournament. It is a very established squad at this point. There's not a lot of changes. that lack of refreshment kind of worries me, Ryan, in the same way I think the lack of refreshment worries you in principle for England. But same sort of argument. I don't know who you're bringing in to replace some of the players in this team. We do have a developing goalkeeper situation, so we've been very lucky for a long time that we had three, what I would consider, top-level goalkeepers. We had Alan McGregor, we had Craig Gordon, and we had David Marshall. And for 15 years, if one was out, we just brought another one in. And we haven't thought about the goalkeeping position for a decade and a half. Now Craig Gordon is out injured long-term. McGregor's retired from international duty. Marshall's retired from international duty. So we have actually gotten Angus Gunn, who is on record as saying his dream is to play for England one day, but we need a goalkeeper, and so Angus Gunn is now Scottish, and I expect he will probably start these two games because he is by far and away, I think, the highest caliber goalkeeper that we have.
Graham, did anyone tell him his name was Angus? Because I feel like that right there should have told him that he's playing for England and nobody else.
Yeah, I think when he said England, he meant Scotland. That's how we're excusing it.
No, I think you can excuse it
that
way. He
just got mixed up between the two.
Something tells me that if you all meet each other in a competitive game, Ryan won't be seeing it or saying it that way. But yeah, I take your point.
To be fair, we have an Australian starting up front in Lyndon Dykes, and I think there are two or three other players that were also born in England.
It's just multiculturalism, man. Multiculturalism.
Exactly.
You're embracing the modern era. It's all
good. Angus Gunn's dad was a Scotland player, right?
His
I
name is Angus.
Know, was he?
Yes.
Brian Gunn must
know.
Have been. He must, surely. Someone look it up. Anyway, I guess
I didn't know that was that Brian Gunn was his dad, to be honest. But
pretty sure
yeah.
he is, yeah. Anyway.
Okay, fair enough. But Angus Gunn looks like he's going to be our new goalkeeper, at least until Craig Gordon is back. I don't know what to expect out of these two games. Steve Clark tends to be kind of defensive-minded. I often think our strength is in the attack. What worries me a little bit is a lot of our best players are not in the best club form. So Kieran Tierney hasn't been playing much for Arsenal. Andy Robertson's had a difficult season for Liverpool, obviously. John McGinn has had a difficult season for Aston Villa. Lyndon Dykes has been out for a long time with kind of a bit of a mystery illness as well. Che Adams is playing for a struggling Southampton team, so that concerns me a little bit as well. But even if we lose and don't qualify, we still have the best kits in international soccer, and all that's mattered. And I got hold of one before they sold out as well. I think it arrives tomorrow. So all in all, that's a win for Scotland, really.
Big
I have an update. I'm fascinated by Angus Gunn. His mother is Susan. She is married to Brian Gunn, a former professional footballer and football manager who she met in Spain, where she had a bridal wear company. He proposed within 3 days of their meeting, and they were married the following year. They remain married. They have multiple children. And there's the Scotland connection right there. He made a whopping 6 appearances for the Scottish national team.
Mm, there you go. Angus is the son of a gun. We proved it. Very good. Scotland playing Cyprus and Spain in this window. Why don't we take a look over at France, who, as we mentioned, are in the group with Netherlands and Republic of Ireland. France playing both of those teams, Netherlands and Republic of Ireland, arguably the trickiest window they're going to face in this Euro qualifying campaign. Taylor, how are we feeling about France right now? It feels tumultuous, and then you remember, they did make a World Cup final, so they're still pretty good.
Isn't the rule just ask Kylian Mbappe how he's feeling about France, and then that's how we should all be feeling about France? Whatever he says is how it goes. Cause
is that right?
I think as long as you have Kylian Mbappe, now their captain, you're going to be okay. Although I believe Antoine Griezmann might disagree. He's vice-captain, but I think was hurt that he wasn't given the armband instead of Mbappe, though I don't know how surprised he really should have been. But the story, as always with France, is just that they're quite good, pretty stacked, have a lot of talent across the board. They have experience. They have youth. They've got, that's the front line alone, like reading from bottom up. You've got Kingsley Coman, Moussa Diaby, Randall Kolo Muani, Marcus Thuram, Kylian Mbappe, Olivier Giroud, always Olivier Giroud in there, and then Antoine Griezmann. That's all of those could start for some of the best national teams on the planet. So to have all of them at your disposal, it's a charmed life Didier Deschamps lives. The midfield, Youssef Fofana from Monaco, Tchouaméni, Kamavinga, Thuram from Nice. I really like Kefren Thuram. I always sign him in FIFA. That's where I go. But whenever I get to watch him with Nice, he is always enjoyable and I think a very dynamic midfielder. Adrian Rabiot somehow still in there, so we still get the drama. You still get the kind of veteran drama mixed with the hype at the same time. Dayo Upamecano could be good, could give up an own goal. You never know. Teo Hernandez could score a worldie or get a red card. Lots to keep you entertained when it comes to France, and I think they will be feeling confident about that game against Ireland, maybe a little bit more conflicted about that game against the Dutch.
Clearly, nobody at the French Federation has worked up the courage to tell Rabiot's mum that he's not included in the squad, just like that nobody there has the courage to tell Mbappe that he's not the captain. That they didn't have a choice. In fact, I think it was probably written into Mbappe's PSG contract that he will be the France captain, and the French Federation just has no say in that matter.
Any of you scored a hat-trick in a World Cup final? Yeah, okay, I'll be captain.
Yeah, it's quite a strong argument, in fairness.
It's decent. It's not bad. I mean, it didn't win, but it's not a bad argument. Graham, any thoughts on this France side as they are now? Ready to kick on in this tournament?
I do think it's quite an interesting point in their development as a team, because three key figures have retired from international duty since the World Cup. So Hugo Lloris has retired. Benzema, he was back in and now he's retired again. And then Raphael Varane, Joe has talked about this a couple times on the show. Only 29, or maybe he's 30 now. You wouldn't say that he is necessarily of international retirement age, but he has talked about being in a washing machine that never stops. Ryan, I know you have questions about Raphael Varane's washing machine.
Makes no sense.
But basically, the long and short is that he is no longer available for France. So those are three key positions to be filled. Deschamps has come out and said publicly that Mike Maignan is the replacement for Hugo Lloris. I personally think William Saliba makes sense as a long-term replacement for Varane, although he is injured and not involved in this squad for this particular window. And then, to be honest, I don't think Benzema really needs to be replaced. I actually think Benzema kind of cluttered France's thinking as an attacking team. And so just having Mbappe, maybe it's Giroud alongside him, because it's always Giroud alongside him, but even someone like Kolo Muani, who has really taken a step forward in his development since the World Cup. He's been in excellent form for Frankfurt in the Bundesliga. So I don't think Benzema necessarily needs to be replaced. So this France team is still in very good shape. They are stacked, as Taylor says, but Deschamps does still have some things to figure out.
All right, last but not least, guys, let's take a quick jaunt to Group J, which contains Bosnia and Herzegovina, Iceland, Luxembourg, Slovakia, Liechtenstein, and Portugal. The clear outlier in that group, I would suggest, although Iceland, obviously, quite decent.
Is it just me, or are at least 90% of Portugal's qualifiers against Liechtenstein? Feels like that they play, that's how Ronaldo's got like 200 international goals. They just play Liechtenstein and Luxembourg in every single qualifier.
It's very much the England-San Marino continuum. Yeah, I think you're right there, Graham.
that's not the continuum I think of as being the most engaging. But anytime you get to use continuum, I say go for it.
And that's why I am the way I am, Taylor, essentially, because that is the continuum I've had to watch growing up. Portugal, Graham.
That really does put it into perspective, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, there you go. Bobby Martinez, or Bobby Martinez, where I come from.
My favourite.
Yeah, what do we think about that? Portugal coach, yay for Portugal.
The jury's still out on that one.
Is it?
So I'm going to try my best to be fair here and sort of make an argument in favour of Roberto Martinez and what he might bring to this Portugal team. So there is going to be a difference between Martinez and Santos as coaches, which is a good thing, because I think we'd all got very bored of watching Santos's Portugal team. So Belgium under Martinez, they like to play it from the back. They like to have the ball. Portugal under Santos do not like those things. They tended to move the ball quicker upfield. I found an article that said they completed fewer passes per sequence than all of the other big European nations in the last qualification campaign for the World Cup. So in theory, this change should be good for Portugal because they just have so much attacking quality. The frustration with Santos was he was hired at a time when Portugal didn't have that quality. That pragmatism was very valuable. They obviously won a Euros under him, but then their squad got stronger, certainly in an attacking sense, and it felt like they outgrew Santos. So Martinez should do a better job of harnessing that talent. We should also expect to see a back three from Martinez. So he's called up 10 defenders for the squad, and six of them are centre backs. And he used a back three for Belgium a lot. In fact, that another article I found said that he used a back three in 75 of his 79 matches in charge of Belgium. So it's a fair guess to say that we will see that for Portugal as well. I have mixed thoughts on that because I'm not sure what the use of that is for Portugal, because you're losing a player further forward. And as I say, the strength in this Portugal team isn't in attacking sense, is in that midfield and certainly those creative areas of the midfield. But nonetheless, I think in theory, Martinez should create a more attack-minded team. And if you look at it over the course of his career, and certainly with Belgium, he was better at building a team from scratch than evolving a team. He never changed things for Belgium. That was my big frustration, was at the World Cup, he was still starting Eden Hazard, despite the fact I think Real Madrid have forgotten Eden Hazard is one of their players.
Tony Kroos hasn't forgotten.
No, he hasn't. He still started him at a World Cup. So if Martinez is coming in and building a team from scratch, then I have more faith in him to do that than a few years down the line where he needs to evolve things. Having said that, Cristiano Ronaldo is in this squad, So maybe I have too much faith in Martinez to change things too much, because he should not be in this squad at this point.
Should he not?
No, I don't think so. He's playing in Saudi Arabia. Gonçalo Ramos certainly should be starting over him. He's doing obviously very well for Benfica at a much higher level. So that maybe is the true test. But I think this was a good opportunity for Martinez to do the Erik ten Hag thing and basically said, look, this is a new generation, a new era. Ronaldo, you're the old era, but he has chosen not to do that, and that will make things very difficult for him further down the line. At some point, this will be difficult for him.
I agree, Graham, but also for Martinez, that is a politically troubling thing to do, right?
He's going to have to do it at some point. He's going to have to do it at some point. Ronaldo's not just going to step willingly to the side, is he? If there's one thing we've learned about Cristiano Ronaldo over the last few months, that is it. That is not going to happen for Portugal, just like it didn't happen for Manchester United. So Martinez is going to have to do this at some point, and surely the easiest point for him to do it is right at the start when he's taken charge of the team and he can put his own kind of impression on things. But he hasn't done that.
I can't remember if it was Roberto Martinez who dropped Raja Nainggolan from the Belgium squad, but if it was, I think that was like the biggest omission he had, or the biggest sort of decision he had to make, aside from maybe like Lukaku versus Benteke, when that was still vaguely a conversation. And so I don't know how many of those sort of big moments he's had, those big decisions he's had. I do wonder if part of his interview was, how are you going to get the best out of Cristiano Ronaldo? Because we still have to have him in the team. His agents will be very mad if we don't. It's not even just that he plays in Saudi Arabia. It's that he was, to my memory, a disruption in the last World Cup for Portugal. And he ends up not playing, and I think is pretty frustrated about it. And there's a lot of vocalizing in the opening games about how he's not getting the ball in the right spots, or not getting it where he wants, or even when he does. It just didn't feel like he was necessarily a part of that team. So maybe that's the reality check he needed. Maybe he's gotten a couple of those since then. But that would be my major question is, if you're building the whole team around him, or if you're structuring the team so that Ronaldo can still play in it, you are sacrificing quality. And to Graham's point, when you then are also potentially moving to a back three, they brought in six center backs, so that feels like a possibility, then you're sacrificing even more attacking talent. And I think it's just going to be a fascinating window. Liechtenstein and Luxembourg are not like true tests of much or anything, but I still just think how this team evolves, and if the chemistry improves, if they look like a unified team, then maybe it's the right hire. But I definitely have some big questions about what happens when this team comes up against sterner, stronger opposition and they have to make some difficult decisions.
Yeah, I'm just distracted now by the thought of Martinez telling Nainggolan he couldn't play anymore. Like, you know, take the cigarette out for a second. Get off the motorbike. I've got something to tell you.
As I understand it, that was the problem. It was, take the cigarette out. Just put it out for a second. We've got to have a conversation. No, you won't even put it out. See, that's part of the problem, is that you won't put it out even to have a conversation.
Indeed. Fun times. All right. I think we have thoroughly previewed this upcoming international break. Taylor, wellness check. Looks like about 50% of the coffee's gone now.
I don't think I've had that much. If anything, I've had more water in this recording. So I'm happy about that. I'm happy to get to see the U.S. play again. I will add very briefly, excited to watch the Dutch play, because I think they are at a fascinating point. When you look at the roster they have, it's a lot of names you know, and then it's a lot of names that I'm more familiar with because we covered Brentford, Feyenoord, Ajax this past weekend. I think Mats Wiefer could be very good for them. Kenneth Taylor is one we were all impressed by. And then Xavi Simons playing for PSV. There are youngsters coming through for the Dutch who will, I think, be household names in the near future. But we might start to see them become more important for the team this time around, especially with Frankie de Jong injured, Ryan Gravenberch not called in, Jeremy Frimpong not in there. So there's some names outside, some young names coming through. And I think the Dutch will be another one to keep an eye on this break.
That's good. Weren't as pleased to watch the Dutch in Qatar, if I remember correctly. But yeah.
For a variety of reasons, especially as an American fan. Yeah, no, indeed. Not my favorite team to watch.
Indeed. Well, Taylor, thank you very much for your contributions in this podcast, as always. Graham Ruthven, thank you yourself. And thank you yourself. That's tautological. Graham, thank you very much. And we hope you enjoy your Mouse House on Ice.
Ah, thank you, Ryan.
Indeed. Listener, thank you very much for joining us on this one. We'll be back on the feed very shortly. But for now, bye!